Samantha Power won a Pulitzer Prize and a National Book Critics Circle Award for her book A Problem from Hell, America and the Age of Genocide. The book, which is now out in paperback, is critical of America's failure to intervene to stop genocide in Bosnia, Kosovo, Rwanda, and Cambodia. One of her chapters is about America's failure in the late 80s to send a strong message to Saddam Hussein that genocide would not be tolerated after he used chemical weapons against the Kurds. Samantha Power was the founding director of Harvard's Carr Center for Human Rights Policy. She teaches human rights and U.S. foreign policy at Harvard. I asked her if she supported the U.S. military action in Iraq before the war started and where she stands now. Let's start with where she stood before the war.
My basic line on the war was, ahead of time, was that the war in Iraq, a unilateral war, would make Iraq a more humane place and the world a more dangerous place. And I came to that, you know, as many people who were agonizing about this war, I came about it with a heavy heart. I sort of plunked, as it were, and I plunked against the war. Again, not because I didn't think it would represent a liberation, as in fact it has, as complicated as nation building is proving, for sure. But I really felt that the United States, at the time it launched the war, had so little capital internationally. That is, that it was trying to make the argument, the humanitarian argument, for war in Iraq within the four corners of Iraq. That is, it wanted to say, here are the abuses he committed back in 1988, and it didn't itself want to come forward and say, okay, and here's why, when Saddam committed genocide in 88, we actually doubled our aid to his regime. That's the case, that's the story that I tell in the book. In addition, of course, it was clearly the third argument that was tacked on after the disarmament argument and then the Al-Qaeda argument proved somewhat unpersuasive to people. It seemed like a last-minute, let's bring out the genocide argument, you know, let's make that case. But my feeling was that these individuals making this argument hadn't themselves brought a sufficient track record to caring for and tending to human rights situations, and I worried that, again, there would be an instant liberation, but that because it was kind of an afterthought, the human rights argument, that we wouldn't actually follow through in the country itself, again, within the four corners, and then also that the ripple effects from this preemptive intervention would actually undermine the one thing that the intervention was for, which was U.S. security.
Now that the major military part of the war in Iraq is over, do you still feel that Iraq will emerge from this war a more humane place, but the world will be a more dangerous place?
The Bush administration launched this war and I think conducts itself on a single premise, which is that it's much more important to be feared than to be liked. And my basic instinct is that as important as it is to be feared, and I do think, if you do have terrorist threats in your midst, you do have to be feared. But as important as it is to be feared, it's equally important or perhaps even more important to be respected. And I think until the United States begins to cobble back together its legitimacy as an international player, until it begins to work within international institutions and even give something up occasionally for the sake of kind of, you know, something resembling a global order where you have certain rules that we don't exempt ourselves from, that the United States doesn't exempt itself from, and then insist that everybody else play by. I think until we begin that, as it were, nation-building exercise or nation-rebuilding, internation-rebuilding exercise, I do feel that the world is less stable, that more people are prone to invoke the preemption doctrine to service whatever their needs are locally. We've already seen everyone from Mugabe, you know, to the Indonesian government sort of citing the war on terrorism and citing preemption as grounds for going after opposition or going after national movements locally, self-determination movements. So I think that you're going to see a contagion effect of sorts.
You're one of the people whose view of American power was changed by Bosnia. How did your view of American power change?
Well, I was a kid when I went to Bosnia. I was 22, I guess, when I went for the first time right out of college. And there was just something to me surreal and gravely disappointing and disheartening about seeing emaciated men behind barbed wire in concentration camps on the one hand, and NATO airplanes flying overhead, monitoring the carnage, but doing nothing about it on the other. And so it was that gap between, you know, kind of never again, you know, I've been steeped on never again, as many from my generation had been. It changed me in that while I had grown up thinking that war was something that had to be avoided at all costs, here was a circumstance where what I wanted, and it wasn't an easy thing to acknowledge that this was what I wanted, but I wanted those NATO planes to do something. That is, I wanted war. And so I think while some people, let's say on the left in America, are really deeply skeptical after Vietnam and so on, of the possibility of American power being harnessed for good, I think having gone through that experience and being almost desperate for American power and recognizing that it was American power or nothing, you know, that the Europeans were not themselves going to do anything, makes me perhaps more willing to entertain, again, the possibility, not the likelihood, but the possibility that the United States can use its resources for liberal ends.
Do you think that Iraq is an example of the liberal quandary on intervention?
I think Bosnia is the best emblem of the quandary, because mm-hmm. you really saw the Clinton administration, again, sort of slow to grapple with the evil, and then once convinced of the evil, very squeamish about asserting American leadership, you know, saying to the Europeans, you know what, this is genocide, we have to go there. You're either with us or you're against us. I mean, in a sense, what the Bush administration has done, the Clinton administration would never have that level of assertiveness and risk-taking with force and risking confronting also the U.S. military, which was quite opposed to intervention. I think that's the better example of it. Certainly, Iraq brought out the conflict within liberal civil society in this country. It brought out some of the squeamishness also in the Democratic Party, you know, of a sort of reluctance to take a meaningful stand on that war, to really push back. But I think Iraq is hard to put in the camp that we were talking about, because the security argument was the one that really persuaded more people than not. And I think the Democratic Party mainly feels disqualified about speaking on that war, less because of its liberal, you know, squeamishness, and more because of the kind of patriotism problem, you know, this feeling that after 9/11 one just has to close ranks and kind of defer to the executive branch regardless.
You are critical in your book of both Republican and Democratic administrations for failing to intervene in genocides. Let's start with the Reagan administration. You say the Reagan administration knew about Saddam Hussein's acquisition and its use of chemical weapons. It knew about its use of chemical weapons in the war against Iran and its use of weapons against the Kurds. What did they knew and what did they know, and when did they know it?
Well, the genocide as we now know it began really in 1987, but there was a kind of 6-month period in early 88, or between February and September of 1988, that it really intensified. And the internal cable traffic and memo traffic reveals extensive knowledge of the use of chemical weapons, the destruction of Kurdish villages in rural northern Iraq. This comes on the heels of successive fact-finding missions to the Iran-Iraq front lines by the United Nations throughout the 1980s, which documented chemical weapons use against Iranian soldiers. So that was very well documented, never sanctioned internationally, because again, the feeling in both instances, both when it came to the genocide against the Kurds and the use of chemical weapons against the Iranians, was, you know, he may be a son of a bitch, but he's ours, you know, and Iran is the greater nemesis in the neighborhood, and so better to have, you know, a bulwark against him, you know, in the region, so better not to denounce the use of a weapon that really hadn't been used in any extensive way since World War I.
You say that the administration of the first President Bush covered up evidence of mass atrocities by Iraq in 1987 and 88 and tried to spin Saddam Hussein as being a kinder, gentler dictator so that we wouldn't have to get involved in Iraq.
Yeah, I mean, none of us like to live with the impressions of ourselves as people who would turn away from genocide, of course. So one of the patterns, once he's repeated in case after case, and the Iraq case is a great example, is we tell ourselves it's actually not genocide. And of course we tell ourselves that working with a regime that is brutal will constitute a form of constructive engagement. That is, that isolating the regime isn't going to achieve anything. And you know, there are those who today would say, look, the policy that we made in the 80s during the genocide was the right one. We tried the isolation approach in the 90s, and look where that got us. Nowhere fast. So it is very, this is what I meant before when I said that, you know, injecting concern for human rights into U.S. foreign policy doesn't always tell you what the best means is to advance those ends. But certainly excluding consideration of human rights, as we did during this genocide and many others, is a recipe for not improving the welfare of foreign citizens. If I could just, there was one memo that was the most perhaps striking of the book and of the 20th century maybe, and that was a memo related to Iraq that came out in or that was issued by the Assistant Secretary for Near Eastern Affairs at the State Department in September 1988, and it said, human rights and chemical weapons use aside, comma, our interests run roughly parallel to those of Iraq. And I think that sort of sums up, in a way, what our response to chemical weapons use, human rights abuses, genocide has been over time, which is genocide, comma, and then what are our security or economic interests.
Now, you're also critical of the Democratic Clinton administration. You point to Warren Christopher, the Secretary of State under President Clinton, forbidding the use of the word genocide to describe murder in Rwanda. How did you find that out?
There's this first-class non-governmental organization in Washington called the National Security Archive that spends its days submitting Freedom of Information Act requests, FOIA after FOIA after FOIA. And they unearthed all of these documents, both from the Bosnia conflict and from the Rwanda genocide. And in both instances, actually, it was Warren Christopher who took a real leadership role within the bureaucracy and said, in both cases, be careful, and this is an exact quote in the Rwanda case, be careful, don't use the word genocide, then we'd actually have to do something. So the perception was, again, if you admit to the American people, if you admit to yourselves, if you admit, you know, how can you look at yourself in the mirror in the morning when you're not only not sending American troops, but when you're not even discussing something that actually rises to the level of genocide? And so that, again, the temptation is just pretend it isn't that. Pretend it isn't that thing that actually sort of implicates our own, you know, perceptions of ourselves.
Your book, A Problem from Hell, is very critical of America for not intervening to stop genocide. Why do you think America has been slow to intervene in most cases?
Well, one of the shocking but quite, I suppose, banal conclusions of the book is that the system is working. I mean, we have a system that is very responsive to two things, to executive leadership, so to presidential leadership on the one hand, and domestic political pressure on the other. And both have been sorely absent when it has come to genocide. No American president, for all of the trips to the Holocaust Museum or all of the slogans of never again, no American president has ever said, not on my watch, you know, genocide is not happening. They've never issued a presidential decision directive signaling the bureaucracy that that's a priority of theirs. They've never issued public speeches or done contingency military planning with our allies so that there can be a division of labor, because God knows this is a massive problem.
Just one more question. You've been writing about AIDS lately. Do you see AIDS as connecting to your work on genocide?
Well, I'm most interested in why good people do nothing, I have to say. I mean, I'm not somebody who has spent all that much time trying to get into the head of the perpetrator of genocide. I sort of take some amount of carnage as fixed on this earth. Perhaps I shouldn't, but I'm really interested in why those who have the power to do something to save large numbers of lives don't do something. And so I went from working on this book on why Americans who have the power to do so much more with less, I mean, even our mere words and our mere economic sanctions and you know, our freezing of the foreign assets of potential perpetrators, I mean, these little things that we could have done could have made a difference in addition to obviously having the military might. So I shifted then to AIDS, where I look at, specifically the government of Thabo Mbeki in South Africa, and ask why? The government that has, you know, accounts for 40% of Africa's GNP, why they are not giving antiretroviral medicines that are now available for $1 a day to their people. Why? I expected more from Nelson Mandela's successor. And so really to get into the head of good people who do nothing for reasons that are very, very logical to themselves, but that have deeply, deeply troubling immoral results.
Samantha Power, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Samantha Power is the author of A Problem from Hell, America and the Age of Genocide. It's now out in paperback. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Julian Hertzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Sherrock directs the show. I'm Tariq Rose.